Maybe you've heard in physics of the superstring theory. Well, that's kind of what we got this hour for you. The theory and practice of some superstring players, pickers, and pluckers. I'm talking about guitar heroes. This hour on Hearing Voices from NPR, I'm Barrett Golden. There's a myth of the boozin', fightin', womanizin', hard-livin' blues man. Well, that man had a name. He's a real guy. Charlie Patton.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lordy.
I'm about to go to jail about this tune.
Having trouble making out these lyrics? Well, you're not alone. Even when this record first came out in 1929, people couldn't understand Charlie Patton.
I tell you what Charlie had, he, just like you hear him singing there, he had a growl in his voice. You know what I mean? He didn't just speak clear like you or me.
Guitarist Booker Miller traveled and played with Patton.
Man, he had a voice, bro. He had a voice. And I did love to hear that voice, too.
And women going crazy, every day they lie by.
He was a master at rhythm, you know, very rhythmic, percussive.
Guitarist and singer Corey Harris.
He has a lot of tunes where he pinches strings. A lot of tunes he's banging on the guitar while he's playing it. So it sounds as if there's someone hitting on a wood box, which makes it sound like there's two people.
Patton was born sometime around 1890 near Edwards, Mississippi. The music he heard when he was growing up, the music of the rural South, was African in origin. It had come to Mississippi by slave boat, from West Africa.
Well, there's a lot of obvious connections between Mississippi and Mali, specifically in West Africa. I went over there 3 different times, and when I was there, Ali Farka Touré showed me this tune that I'll play, which is, I don't think if I played it for anyone that they would know whether it was from Mali or whether it's from Mississippi.
I'd walk through the country then. I know there's a lot of people in the country. Stop and spend the night playing a little guitar and just cook for me. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I walked everywhere I wanted to go, but I know people walking.
Honey Boy Edwards was another of the blues singers who roamed Mississippi in the 1920s.
So I'm from the Delta. The Delta where they're picking a lot of cotton and gathering sweet potatoes, corn, peanuts, and there was money in the Delta in the fall of the year. There's a lot of whiskey makers was in there. They made corn whiskey, white whiskey. It's take if I lived in the Delta. There wasn't no job to do, but I got a big whiskey steer. I run off probably 40, 50 gallons of whiskey a night. And probably I'm giving country dances every Saturday night. I'm making whiskey, I'm getting dances every Saturday night. I'm selling mine. Be gambling at the house, drinking whiskey, playing guitars. All the music you're about, blues come out the Delta and you're about. Often plantations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Charlie Patton. We stayed on the same plantation.
Pop Staples of the Staple Singers.
Charlie would play those breakdowns, you know, and Saturday night suppers. In those days, that was swinging music, you know, that's what they call it now. That was really swing.
Yeah, this is the 20s and the 30s, and this was really going strong. The whole plantation life was really vibrant.
Jim O'Neill, co-founder of Living Blues magazine, says the blues gradually moved from the countryside into town.
Towns like Clarksdale and Greenwood and Greenville and Indianola and the Delta, which were kind of the centers of the cotton commerce. So the cotton merchants would do business there, and so musicians would play there, and that's where a lot of the field hands would go on Saturday night. They might go to a place on the plantation if someone was having a kind of a house party, but otherwise they might head for the nearest town. There was always action there. There was people in Clarksdale who can remember on a Saturday night where you could hardly walk because there were so many people.
If you follow me, babe, I'll turn your money green.
Then we had a lot of people who liked to dance and drink and get out on the floor and clown, having a good time, eating barbecue.
I'll show you more money Rockefeller ever seen.
Put a whole hog on a barbecue grill. 2 men to turn him and mop him down with that hot sauce. It was good. Yeah, it was good, yeah.
River was whiskey, baby, and I was a duck.
Honey Boy Edward says if Charlie Patton was in the crowd, there was bound to be trouble.
He was a hellraiser. He'd fight and drink a lot of white whiskey. He was a hellraiser. He'd break up his own dances. He would break up his own dances.
Patton was kind of a man of mystery, a figure of legend, even in his own time. I think it's significant that he made records under the name The Masked Marvel because, you know, no one really quite knew who he was.
Francis Davis, author of The History of the Blues, says Patton's a legend because we don't know much about him.
We know that he lived on various plantations, usually got into trouble. He was almost like a resident musician, almost like a resident songster on one of the plantations. He would often get in trouble for, as I think one plantation owner who fired him put it, you know, keeping the women up all night and making them useless for work the next day.
So let's sing a little song like this.
Apparently he was married numerous times.
Jim O'Neill.
I found a lot of marriage certificates in the state of Mississippi. It wasn't just him shacking up. He actually went through the process of getting a marriage certificate at least 8 times, and I haven't found any divorce papers yet.
Bigamist or not, Patton had a religious side. He made records as the elder J.J. Haddon.
Get out of the way, old son, stop winning the crown. I hear him call him a Lord. Oh, Lord.
He sang gospel with one of his wives, Bertha Lee. Charlie Patton's death, like his life, was the stuff of legend.
Charlie Patton, he died in 1934. Charlie has got cut on his neck, and he's fighting with somebody, and 1934.
Charlie Patton is like one of the bedrock individuals at the foundation of the 20th century guitar style, you know, and also blues songwriting. And
Corey Harris
had a great influence on so many people, you know. He taught Pop Staples how to play guitar. Robert Johnson learned from him. Honey Boy Edwards learned from him and played with him. You know, Son House was about Charlie Patton's age, but he was very much influenced by him.
Howlin' Wolf recalls he was plowing mules on a plantation when Patton stopped by.
Man come through there picking a guitar called Charlie Patton, and I liked his sound. So I always did want to play a guitar. So I got him to show me a few chords, you know. Every night that I'd get off of work, I'd go over to his house and he'd learn me how to pick the guitar. So I got good with it. I've been playing ever since. I played all through Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama.
I don't.
died on.
You know.
Died on. Died on.
Little Axe from their album The Wolf That House Built. Larry Massa recorded that interview with Honey Boy Edwards. It was collected for the NPR series Honky Tonk Hymns and the Blues by Steve Rapp. They also recorded the interview with Corey Harris, who came in the studio to play for us. All the other songs, the Charlie Pattons, there was some Furry Lewis in there, Sun House, they're off a Charlie Patton box set, Screamin' and Hollerin' the Blues. You are hearing voices of guitar heroes and other string pickers and pluckers, like the ones Jack Chance met in Asia for the Mountain Music Project.
It's Sunday afternoon on the street bazaar in Chiang Mai, Thailand. Tourists gawk and locals hawk their wares in a river of ethnic handicrafts, pirated DVDs, and overdriven stereo speakers. Then, on a corner outside a Buddhist temple, a man holds a strange instrument to his chest. He plucks a string, and a quiet sound stops the parade. This instrument is called the pin pia, and according to my new friend here, there's only about 50 people who can play it.
ในเมืองไทยนี่ผมคิดว่าถ้าคนที่เล่นพินเปี้ยได้ดีแล้วก็รู้เรื่องพินเปี้ยพอสมควรมีแต่คนที่มีฝีมือพอเล่นได้ดีก็ประมาณ20คนครับผม
His name is Manop Tamadumpinich. He's a music teacher in Luthier, specializing in traditional Lana music. Lana was an old kingdom in northern Thailand.It included parts of Burma, Laos, and southern China. Manop tells me there are 1,000-year-old stone carvings with pin pia players engraved on them. The rippling effect comes from a coconut cup attached to the neck of the instrument and rocked against the chest, releasing the unique sound.Manop tells me that the name of the instrument, pin pia, means strong. Hundreds of years ago, a king of Chiang Mai banned the instrument because its sharp tuning pegs could potentially be used as a weapon by unruly musicians. Something this mellow, a danger to the crown.Makes me wonder. You can find Manop every Sunday afternoon playing these songs along the street bazaar in Chiang Mai, Thailand. For NPR, I'm Jack Chance.
You might not know me. I'm a bass player.
I had a friend that used to sell cars. And I ran into him one day and he said to me, he said, you know, because of you, I'm selling a lot of cars. And I said, you mean me? He said, no, the instrument you play, bass. And I said, how so? He said, young guys would come into the showroom and they'd just look at a car and they'd say, can I have the key? And get inside and turn on the radio and turn the bass all the way up and turn the volume all the way up. And if the car, I mean, if the speakers didn't break up, he said, I'll take it. Didn't care what kind of motor it had, and they didn't even look in the trunk to see what space in it, just all because of the bass. In the beginning, when I first started, the main part of the bass was to learn the changes to each song. But when I went with Dinah and started hearing the words and the melody, I'm learning the whole song instead of just the bottom part, and also the middle and the top. And then I found out that I liked almost being like a tailor.
You go to my head and you linger like a haunting refrain, and I find you spinning round in my brain like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. Oh, you go to my head.
My concept is that the singer comes out there, is buck naked, and it's my job and then to dress that person for the audience. A person comes in, and if I'm a tailor and they want a certain type of a jacket made with a double vent, and this big guy wants something made with no vent and so forth, if you dress each one of those the way that they want to be fitted, and when they come out of there, their clothes fit them well, you're a good tailor. And I started tailor-making my bass to fit for the singer.
Oh, I love my man. Yes, my heart belongs to daddy, cause my daddy, he cheats so well. Diamonds.
24 years with Ella was, you know, top of the learning point.
What else did you say about him, Keita?
You don't say.
What? What? Oh, the dirty old man!
When you write things, you write something that you feel from within. On the last album, I wrote a song called Pinky's Waltz, and that was dedicated to my wife who had passed away. At the recording studio, she and Etta Jones were sitting there talking, and they were talking about chemo. You know, you learn a lot on the golf course. A doctor friend I was playing with one day, he said something to me, he was questioning, he loved jazz, but he questioned me about what's the closest of all the rhythms in music, what's the closest to the heartbeat? And I tried to figure out, I couldn't say what, and he said, well, 3-4. 3-4 is the closest, which is waltz time. There's just a little snap to it, and that's the way the heart beats. Ba-boom. 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 So I said, I'm going to put this in a waltz, because it shows that it's really coming from the heart.
This is basic plucking, or the Staunton lick. Hold down the chord of C, pluck a fretted bass string with the thumb of the right hand, then pluck the third, second, and first strings all together with the first, second, and third fingers of the right hand. ¶¶
Jazz bassist Keeter Betts died in 2005. David Shulman interviewed him in 2003 for the series Musicians in Their Own Words. It's on the web at ownwords.org. You are hearing Voices with Lemon Jelly. Coming up, we sit in on a masterclass with classical guitarist Christopher Parkening. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing Voices of Guitar Heroes. Coming up, a masterclass with Christopher Parkening, but first, David Greenberger and the Bird Songs of the Mesozoic.
I don't know a goddamn thing about a guitar. It's a 10-string instrument, a 12-string instrument. You strum it and you tune it. After you tune it, you start to play. It's not an easy instrument to play. It's easy enough, but you strum it. You just make sure you cut your nails right. You strum it with your fingers. It's like a mandolin, and you cross your leg over and you strum it with your fingers. You tune it. You tune it yourself. A-E-I-O-U. That's the way you tune it. A-E-I-O-U. And then you play it. Have you got a guitar? Don't you strum it? It's steel that you strum. V-I-O-L-I-N. Violin. They have steel strings. You know Elvis Presley? He's dead. He was playing it and they went and shot him. I can't tell you much about Elvis Presley. And his guitar? Well, I haven't got it. Who has got it? I don't know. A guitar has different strings on it, and they don't match up sometimes to the white speck on each and every line. Let's see now. Yeah, sometimes they have this electric guitar and they place it in the guy's hands. Then they have a pick, and a pick is to not hurt hands. See, the guitar, when you move around, it scratches the hand, and sometimes it causes bleeding. And if they're feeling tenderness, then they have to stop and have their hand treated. And then, well, they have to give up the guitar. Now, some people don't like guitar playing because they like the ballet. When they get worked up to a sweat, they take time off. Oh, and the electric guitar, girl or boy can play it, but they still have to have the knob there for the strings. And when you play the guitar, there's a scale, and in the scale there's 7 notes, and they play those notes so their hands won't be abrupt.
A visit to a classical guitar masterclass. I'm Susan Stamberg. The master in this case, Christopher Parkening. The class at Montana State University. Parkening lives nearby in Bozeman. In 1979, he retreated there, burned out after a frenetic and very successful 12-year career. For 3 years, Parkening stopped practicing, did a lot of fishing, and discovered Christianity. But he continued his master class. He's been teaching it since 1975. These days, Parkening is performing and recording again, but every summer he returns to Montana to teach and fish, and takes with him musical memories from earlier years.
My cousin Jack Marshall was staff guitarist at MGM Studios, and when I asked him at the age of 11 about studying the guitar, he suggested that I start with classical, because he said you can go into any style of playing with much greater ease first having learned the classical technique. And he suggested that I start with classical and get the records of Andre Segovia, who he said was the greatest guitarist in the world. So that's what I did. Segovia was my musical inspiration through the years, and I have admired his playing above all the guitarists, and I think simply he single-handedly put the guitar in a position of being a major concert classical instrument. I have had the great opportunity to study with him through the years, and I'm very grateful for that, and I have tried to pattern somewhat not only my teaching but my playing after his.
Now, this is Parkening playing. It sounds so similar to that of Segovia. But the link between Parkening and Segovia is stronger than style or color. At Segovia's first master class in 1962, his youngest student was 15-year-old Christopher Parkening. In 1986, Parkening accepted a Grammy for the maestro, and just a few months before his death, Segovia named Parkening one of his most brilliant students, along with John Williams and Elliot Fisk. Segovia placed great emphasis on teaching. He felt it was the best way to ensure the guitar's continued vitality. And Christopher Parkening's master class runs much the same way Segovia's did. 10 to 12 students, from teenagers to professionals, chosen for an on-stage lesson one-on-one with the master.
Do you want to start again?
The Christopher Parkening Masterclass at Montana State University is set up in such a way that we have Mr. Parkening on stage with a performing student, and the performing student is actually playing not only to Mr. Parkening but to the entire audience.
Let me show you something here. If I could borrow your guitar for a moment. In the original version, the harpsichord can ring the B through the C, but we can't, obviously, because it's the same string. But here's a way to do that that kind of conveys that.
I was wondering how you did that on the record.
With all these other people, we watch a lesson happen.
I switched up the fingering.
So it doesn't tell you that. No,
it doesn't say it.
I was wondering how you did that.
So.
Done here by being on stage is reconstruct a concert situation. You have an audience which is listening to every note, and they're making evaluations as you play, as well as he is. Any comments for Greg?
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed the performance a lot. There were some gorgeous sounds in there, but I had a little trouble finding the rhythm of the piece. I couldn't get it.
Rhythm is the key.
It's a tango. That's what it is. And he starts out the tango really nice. I thought, wow, that sounds good. And the sound was so good. And he had a lovely vibrato. And I thought, this is going to be really something. And then the rhythm got so unrecognizable that it's that dum, bum, 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 bum. It's that dotted rhythm that has to occur throughout the entire piece. That's the major thing. Any other comments?
It might help to imagine that you have a rose in your teeth.
I've played it real exaggerated.
One thing about playing for somebody like Christopher Parkening is that you can trust the fact that the guy is going to be pretty darn objective. I mean, because actually, one thing that a teacher can really do, which is really probably the most important thing, and that is be truthful with you.
Why don't you start, and I'll stop you. Bass notes, I like the fact that you're accenting those, though they seem a little bit overdone. They're a little harsh, they're buzzing somewhat, and yeah, that's much better. And that descending pattern, that should also be pizzicato.
Oh.
Yeah.
Tone. I was getting a really thin sound last year, and pointed that out to me. And I'm getting this is what I consider a good sound, like something like this. Like that. And as opposed to something like this, that's a thinner, harsher sound, you know. And he noticed that right off, and he worked with me. Tomorrow I'm playing a Bach fugue, and I think he's going to have a lot more to say about it.
Okay, Peter, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Peter Fletcher, and I'm from Atlanta. And today I'm going to play the Bach fugue in G minor.
But an A minor, right?
That's correct. It'll be an A minor. It's hard for anyone to go up and play in front of Chris Parkening, you know. And I was very, very nervous. That is a performance. The first time you go up and play for Chris, he will not stop you because that's your performance, you know. And then after you play, of course, he tells you what he thinks.
I would compliment Peter on his left hand. I think his left hand is in a beautiful position, very close to the fingerboard. He noticed his knuckles were parallel to the fingerboard. He's very close. I really like his left-hand position a lot. I too felt the piece was a little bit pushed, a little rushed. There were quite a number of wrong notes, some wrong chords, and quite a few missed notes. And I would suggest, Peter, that maybe that's a fault of the way you practice. I was asked a question earlier this morning about Segovia's advice to me, you know, what advice he gave to me, and he had invited me to Spain to judge an international guitar competition with him. And at the end of that competition, and I'd studied with him some in his hotel room, and I'm leaving to go to the plane, and he says, Christopher, come here. And I came I came over to him, and he gave me a hug goodbye, and he leans over to me, and he says this, and just about like this, with his index finger up. He says, "Christopher, work very hard." And I sat back, and it was almost as though, you know, I thought, well, does he mean I haven't worked hard? And what? And I know later what he really meant by that. You know, he felt this young kid maybe had some natural ability, and in order to bring out your potential, you have to discipline yourself and work very hard. And I think that's Peter's problem at this point. If I could zero into any area, I would say it's his practicing. He's getting good instruction. He has all the natural ability and natural talent. But I see so many areas where it looks like to me you're just passing over. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's all nerves with you, is it?
Not really. I was really nervous at first. But I think you're right. You know, I think I need to go back and
slow things down and play it as though you were going to record it, and every note has to be right, and fight with yourself in terms of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I appreciate
Peter,
it.
You're sure welcome. Yeah. Work hard.
I'm going to take everything you said to heart. You know, he said, I think the last thing he said to me was work hard. While everyone was clapping, you know, and that's what I plan to do. So it's just a really great inspiration to go up and play for someone that great.
Your mind plays tricks on you, and sometimes you think that you're going to show him how good you are, and you get up there and you realize that that doesn't have anything to do with this. That's not why we're here.
Can you try that other than play with the nail of the thumb, either... another way to strum, so they almost sound like harmonics, just as bells, quote unquote. But you'd have to change the way you strum.
Okay.
Yeah, almost real ethereal. They're just coming in.
Okay.
That's better. When a student has a very good foundation in technique and the piece is well in control, I enjoy working on the interpretation of the piece with them and give them some guidelines, not only as to what the composer wanted, but some suggestions in terms of shadings and colors and phrasing. And that's actually my favorite part of guitar teaching. What you might do, since this is almost a direct repeat, change your color here, and then Segovia changes the color again with the harmonics.
Okay.
And you start there, and then change the color here. More Ponticello.
More Ponticello there?
Maybe go the other way. In 1972, after I had sent Segovia a copy of a Bach album that I had done, he wrote me a very kind letter back, and in that letter he described the guitar. He said, "The beauty of the guitar resides in its soft and persuasive voice, and its poetry cannot be equaled by any other instrument." And I thought that was a wonderful description of the instrument that we love so much.
The guitar is a beautiful instrument because you can spend your entire life with it making discoveries, and it keeps you feeling very young. I heard somebody say once that music was enough to last an entire lifetime, but that a lifetime really wasn't enough for music.
Thank you.
Christopher Parkening from his album Grace Like a River. This is Hearing Voices, spending time with some guitar heroes. Coming up, Chuck Campbell of the Sacred Steel Band, another in the series of musicians in their own words.
I think every member of our church, the majority of the members of our church, can remember the first time they heard a steel guitar. We're brought up in our tradition to mimic the voices of the African American Pentecostal church. Everything is vocalized in our church, and we call in response on everything from sermons to prayers to offerings. So if someone is moaning, you get the low moans. You get a judgment from the congregation. And you know that you have reached that pinnacle when they come up after service and say, "You made that thing talk." Band Campbell Brothers, we have two steels. So my brother is playing a lap steel, my younger brother, and I play the pedal steel. And at times it is eerie, and you think it's a singer until you realize it was the steel. We always thought church was a burden in some ways, but to the musician, it was an opportunity that you played every week and you would get total response. So you go to church and you try out something, and someone comes up and say, "God, you had that thing sound like a trumpet." And I think the greatest compliment we get on morning train is different musicians come up to you and say, "You know, hey, man, that was one of the best trains I ever heard in my life." The steel guitar is one of the most expressive instruments I've ever seen because there's no frets. You can play in between notes. But unlike a violin, it also has this sting of a guitar. And so it's not just passive, it's stinging too. I can't express to you how much I love the instrument. I'm just so grateful that God bless people to create it. I'm hoping to leave people with the sharing of the music, evangelizing the steel guitar.
I met Sonam on the road in Tibet. He was dressed in dusty rags. His face bore deep wrinkles from the high-altitude sun. I asked this Tibetan troubadour to play me a few songs. This one's called Good Karma That We Meet Again. It was the Tibetan New Year, Losar, when Tibetans make the pilgrimage to their capital. They meet friends and family and offer their prayers at the Jokhang Temple in Lhasa. Some of them prostrate for thousands of miles to get here. I came to Lhasa looking for street musicians. Believe it or not, Tibet's got a lot of them. There's this bluesy tone that I love in many of these songs. The most common instrument in Tibetan folk music is the dan yen. It looks like a long, thin banjo. The songs are often about the beauty of the land, a funny story that happened on the road, or sometimes subtle jokes about the Chinese army. We won't play those so I don't land anyone in jail.
How is the feeling about it?
As I walk around Barkhor Square in Lhasa's Tibetan quarter, it's easy to see the effects of the Chinese occupation. The not-so-hidden cameras, the cops with eager billy clubs, the monk winking as he flashes a locket with the Dalai Lama's photograph inside. Although Tibetans are allowed to visit the sacred Jokhang Temple, they're not allowed to congregate in groups outside this holy site. Still, these colorful yak herders and barley farmers are smiling. A Buddhist nun invites me in for some yak butter tea. She's very friendly, even to some rather loud tourists from Beijing. She sings as she prints pages of prayers. She asks me to take a letter to her sister, a refugee in Nepal. Outside, families gather in front of the temple, sharing tea and biscuits, smiling broadly, and when no one's around, quietly singing these old Tibetan songs.
You have to tune a guitar according to whatever you're going to play. Like a bass, you can't touch too much, it's already set. You don't fool with the strings too much. If you do, you're going to break them. Sure as hell you're going to break them. But guitars, you got to tune according to each song. You can't just go at it. No, no. You got to regulate it. You got to adjust your strings. Because if you don't, you're not going to be in tune with the music. There's no use having a guitar in your hand or sitting with the quartet unless you're in tune. You got to be regulated right. If you're off guard, you're going to throw the singer off guard. I won't say they're easy to play. No, I won't say that. They're hard to play. You got to concentrate on what you're doing. There are so many different chords a guitar has to hit. You got to hit here and there in a song. It's hell. You got to concentrate. If you don't know what you're doing, you might as well put the guitar down and walk away. It's just no good. When you get going, though, with your guitar, you're just concentrating on what you're doing, and there's no way I can stop you. If I do, I'm going to throw you off key. If I try and have conversation with you, which I won't do, no way. If I wave, I'll throw you off balance, throw the whole quartet off. The whole shooting match will be thrown off. See, I move away over to another corner. The whole thing with a guitar player, Dave, is to just stay away from him. Let him go. Don't interfere with him. Let that man alone. Don't try and have conversation with him while he's playing. Guitars make good music. Banjo, plink, plink, plink. Guitars play at dances. Drink beer and wine down at Pete's Bar. Wake up with a big head. Guitar goes plink, plink, plinky, plink.
Call on the bell.
That's from the album by David Greenberger and the Bird Songs of the Mesozoic called 1001 Real Apes. I'm Barrett Golden, coming to you from Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana. Musicians in Their Own Words is on the web at ownwords.org. And there's links to everything you heard this hour, including the radio pieces and film by Jack Chance from his year-long trek through Asia for the Mountain Music Project. It's all at hearingvoices.com. Oh, Lord. Oh,
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.